And good morning. Here we go. It is a Getaway Friday, Friday, June the 28th, 2019. And what a big day it is here at WWGH Radio, because today we are joined by a part of television history, a legend to be sure. Hee-haw, the legendary TV series went on the CBS television network 50 years ago today. As a matter of fact, 50 years ago this month, I believe it is, June of 1969 on CBS. And the only person left from the original cast that was on the first episode and the last episode joins us in studio today and all day today up until 4 o'clock, and then is going to head over to Perkins Restaurant here in Marion to do a book signing of her new autobiography. This is my story. This is my song. Of course, we talk of the legendary Lulu Roman. Lulu, we've been on the phone so many times. What a pleasure it is to see your face in person here in the studio.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be seen, dear. Thank you very much.
Lulu, how did the book come about?
I have had conversation with Scott for several years, and he just kept saying, we need to write this book. We need to write this book. So we actually sat down one day and went, okay, so let's do this. And, boy, I'll tell you what, it turned out great. This kid's a great writer. He wrote this book, and it sounds like me talking. It does.
What is the best part of the book to you? What part did you like the best?
Boy, that's hard to say, because there's so many things. You know, I've had so many wonderful, incredible things that God's done for me. I have. The highlight, of course, would be getting saved, giving my heart to Jesus, and making a major change in my life.
Tell people about where you were before that moment and how it all happened.
I was an orphan kid. I grew up in an orphan's home in Dallas. And never had a mother or a father or a room of my own or a puppy or a doll or any of that stuff, you know. And when you were put in the orphan's home, you were either adopted or you stayed until you graduated. I went in when I was about 3 and a half, almost 4 years old. And I stayed until I graduated in 1964. So when I got out of there, I was pretty angry, and I had made up my mind that I was going to live my life the way I wanted to. I had my own bucket list, and of all the things that I wanted to do, at the top of that list was I wanted to learn how to cuss, and I got that down really good, which was not too swift of me, because they made sure we had jobs at the telephone company. So more than once I had service assistants running up and down that hall saying, you can't say that! You can't. To which I said, I just did. Mm. You know, well, eventually it cost me my job. I was a pretty sharp little cookie back then, and I found out, you know, you could get into the union, they couldn't mess with you a whole lot. So I saved myself 2 years, you know, by jumping in as a union steward. And then when I was dismissed from the telephone company, I kind of found myself out in the street. I did. Didn't know what to do with me. Didn't know, you know, where I would go or whatever. Had no idea, truly, that God had a plan for my life. I was pretty upset with this God character, because this orphan's home shoved God and shoved religions down our throat. So I was pretty much finished with it when I got out of there. I thought it was. God had other plans. And so I had started to use drugs as a young girl in the orphan's home. Mm. They sent us out to public schools. And in the public schools, we found a lot of things that could make you get real high. And my objective at that point in my life was to get high enough to get away from the ugliness of reality. And my reality was that people always said to me from the time I was a young kid, you're fat and you're ugly and no one will ever love you. And I listened to Fatty Fatty 2x4 Can't Get Through the Kitchen Door, to which I have come to the conclusion, if I'd have been as smart as I am now back then, I would have said, obviously I did. And I got something good and you didn't. And that got me, you know. So I was pretty upset with everything in my life, I was. And just jumped into the drug scene with a force. Bought it, sold it, did it, lived in it, ate, drank, slept it. Just stayed stoned for years, I did. And I ran into one of the kids from the orphan's home. This is kind of a short story of it. And she said, I want to take you someplace. And I said, don't tell me you're going to take me to your church. Well, yes, she was. And I said, I don't think so. Well, by then, I had had my first baby. Damon was 6 months old. And one night, she and a friend of hers just knocked on my door, and I opened the door, and there they stood with hundreds of jars of baby food. I had never seen anything like that in my life. Up until then, if anybody got, you know, if I got anything from anybody, I had to do something to get it. I did. Well, they just brought me an exorbitant amount of baby things for Damon. And, you know, that'll get your attention. It did. So the next time they asked me to go to church, it was like, maybe I ought to go with them. So I went. I did. And I went, I think it was just not quite 2 weeks. And I was very taken with this pastor from the very beginning. He was tall and had silver hair, and he's had the bluest eyes I have ever seen. He was very handsome, well put together man, and very, very smart, and very full of the Spirit of God. And it shined through him, you know. I didn't know how to explain that. I just knew there was something about that man that I could not let loose of. So when she invited me to go back, I wanted to go back every time, because I didn't realize it at that point, but my spirit was really listening to him. It wasn't just me so much as it was my spirit. And on April the 11th of 1973, I always sit in the back of the church on the last row. And my friend Diane and I were sitting there, and he started walking down that aisle, and he got about halfway down. I thought, oh my gosh, this man's coming after me. Mm-hmm. And boy, I was dead right. That's exactly what he did. He came right to where I was, slid into the row in front of me, grabbed hold of both of my hands, and he said, I know who you are. And he said, I wouldn't embarrass you for anything. But he said, could I introduce you to my church? And I thought, no way. Mm-hmm. You know, the next thing I knew, I was standing up there going, you know, he introduced me, because there were people just all around touching me and hugging me and patting on me. I was not someone that let people touch me. Okay. I was not used to being touched. So I was pretty fried when they started hugging and patting and touching and stuff. But ended up, we went back into his office, into his study that night. He ultimately, what he did was said to the church, go home. Because they had all, I did not know this, but Diane had told them, the whole church knew, and they were all praying for me, every one of them. And by then I was in the middle of all the drug charges too. So, we went and sat in his office, and somehow we ended up on the floor, on our knees. And he said, you're in a lot of trouble, aren't you? And I said, yeah. He said, you fixed to go to jail. I said, for 20 years. Yeah. And he said, you know, God can take that away. And I said, sure. You betcha. And he said, Lou, we'll talk to the Lord about this. But he said, let me tell you something, little girl. He said, do not toy with this. To which I thought, yeah, 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 you know. So I said, all right. And he just led me in a little simple sinner's prayer. And I had had my drugs before I went to church that night. I had my drugs before I went to church every time, you know, the first couple of weeks that I went. And by then I was not just playing around. I was sticking needles in my veins. And when I asked Jesus to come into my life, boy, he came. He did. And I remember I was instantly on my feet, kind of almost jumping around, and I caught myself. And he said, no, no. He said, don't stop. He said, the word says you praise God any way you want to. He will receive your praise, you know. And I thought, okay. So jumping around like a fool, it doesn't bother me. Well, the whole church was jumping around, and there they were. So I went home and put my little baby to bed and got up the next morning and thought, I need to clean up my life. I need to clean up my house, you know. And so I just started cleaning. And I looked down at my watch, and it was 12 noon. And I thought, wow, I haven't had any drugs. So I called Diane. I said, you need to get over here. I said, I have not had any drugs this morning. And I said, I know I'm going to have to go through withdrawals. And she had been through the very same thing. She knew what I was going to have to go through. And so she came immediately. And we just got busy, and we cleaned the house some more, made some iced tea, played cards, you know, just, you know, sat around and talked. And hours went by, and she said, Lou, you okay? And I said, I'm fine, you know. And she just jumped up and said, you've been delivered! You know? And I said, what? You've been delivered from drugs? I said, what? Well, I actually was. I never had any withdrawals. I never got sick. I was not uncomfortable for one second. And God put that whole church around me to watch all this go on. And then when I went through the drug trials, the church was with me. It's one little story I'll tell you here that was very funny. I had to go before the judge, you know, a couple of times before it was time for the sentencing. And so I think it was maybe the second or the last time, close to the end of it, when everybody from my church came down, and they'd walk up and down the halls and they'd pray, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And the judge said to me one day, who are all those people out there? You know, and I said, well, that's my church. I said, they're praying for me. To which she was astounded. You know, she couldn't say anything. And then she was like a sitting, I don't know what it was, but she wasn't the main judge. The judge came in, and his name was R.T. Scales. Mm. Like, and I had been busted, I think it was twice before. In Texas, you don't get probation two times in a row, much less three. So everybody was pretty prepared for me to go to jail. And with all my people running up and down those halls praying, getting everybody's attention, he sat there and gave me a 10-year probated sentence. Mm. To which everybody was like, "What?" So we got out of there as quick as we could. And later, someone said, you know, how'd that happen? I said, you know, it had to be God. And they actually did an article in the paper. They followed me through the whole thing. You know, the Dallas Morning News and the Times Herald, they were all doing stories on Lulu busted for drugs. And one of them said to him, why did you give her a probated sentence? And he said, I don't know. Mm. And I said, I do. But God just worked through that whole thing. He did just, you know, it's just like took it and just threw it away. And I had done probably maybe 2 or 3 years probation. And my little probation officer said to me one time, if everyone that was in this probation office, you know, behaved as well as you do, we would not have a problem with this. And somewhere there was a group of charges or something that had some little lady, when she was going out of office, I think when she was losing her job, had taken one of those charges against me, stuck them in a drawer or something way in the back. And she was retiring, and after, you know, 5 or 6, 7 years, they found this thing. And so they came to my house to arrest me again. Mm. And I said, what did I do? And they said, nothing. This charge has not been taken care of. So they said, either you make an application for a full and complete pardon, or you go do the time. So long story short, we had everybody that was, you know, in the gospel community there, you know, Jim Baker, Pat Robinson, you know, all these big Christian, you know, ministries, wrote letters because I had gone to sing for them and talk to them and given my testimony. And it was amazing. It truly was amazing. Nobody could believe it, you know, and it was just God just clearly did a miraculous thing in the midst of all of these people watching.
Mm. What an amazing story that is.
It is.
When you were going through that, being on a network television series, and as you say, the newspapers are writing articles about what's going on. We see a lot of that nowadays.
Yes.
When somebody gets in trouble, who we all know, it's on the front page of the papers. And how hard does that make it when you're on the newspapers, on the evening news, for something like that?
It's insanely hard because every second of every day, you're wondering, what is going to happen with my life? Where am I going to end up? Am I going to die in jail? It's terribly, terribly frightening, it is. But I was in a stage in my life, too, where I was truly learning to not walk in fear, but to walk in faith and in trust, you know. And that's what my objective to do was every day, was just walk in faith. And God just really... It was like he just picked me up, moved me up on top of it, you know. And we made application for a pardon and went to see the governor. I took my little babies with me. And my pastor went and some other people went. And we went before Texas. I don't think it was the Supreme Court. I can't remember exactly what it was, but we went for a panel of judges and told, you know, they all told why they thought I should be given a pardon. And so then we had to go home and wait and wait and wait and wait. And I think it was about maybe 6 or 8 weeks. Here came a big envelope in the mail, and it was a full and complete pardon from the governor of the state of Texas. And then where they just wipe it clean and you can't see it anymore?
Expunge.
Yeah, expunge.
Expunge, that's what it is. Then they expunged it.
Mm.
You want to talk about God working in somebody's life? Okay. I'm a bouncing ball in Jesus' hands.
It's an amazing story.
It is.
And when you think back to that time now, when you were going through those things, why do you think you got there? Why do you think that you fell into the drug culture, that things like that happened?
I was personally trying to get away from mental anguish, from having a broken heart, from being totally abandoned and not feeling like anybody on the face of this earth really cared whether I lived or died. And that's pretty hard to walk through when you are not convinced that you're going to make it.
when this all came together, how did show business come into the life of this little girl who was an orphan at the orphanage?
I had a girlfriend who, I have some very funny stories in the book, some of them are. She wanted to be a dancer. And so she is what led me into, should we say, the show business side of life. It was not really show business at that point. I worked in the Dallas nightclubs for years as a go-go dancer, is what they called it. I was crazy. And in working in the clubs, we had opportunity to meet celebrities. And I had come out in the parking lot. There's a place called Dewey Groom's Longhorn Ballroom. I think it might actually still be there in Dallas. It was the last time I went, and that, but that's been like 20-some-odd years, I think. But I was had gone down to get my paycheck. This fellow that paid us owned four or five of these different places, and we used to dance at one called Spot 77 out on Denton Highway. And I went to get a paycheck. And my girlfriend ran out and said, "You've got to come over here. Buck Owens is over here." And I said, "Who?" And she said, "Buck Owens." And I said, "Who?" She said, "Buck Owens, Lou, you know, cowboy." I said, "No, I was a hippie kid, honey. I ate LSD and ran around in water fountains. I was not into country music. I knew no country people. I knew no country names." And when she said Buck Owens, I was like, I don't know. But here came this big, tall cowboy, and he had on this hat, you know, and he was authentic, you know. He was a cowboy-looking cowboy. And she introduced me to him, you know, and I said, "Hey, cowboy," you know. And he said he had already invited her and a couple of her friends to go to dinner, and he said, "You come along with us." So I went to eat with him that evening, and it just started a great friendship. It really did. But and he got to a place, he used to tell me, he said, "You're the funniest thing I have ever seen." And he said, "One of these days, you're going to be a big star, and I'm going to have something to do with it." Boy, I thumped that cowboy hat, and I said, "Keep talking, baby." You know, he just laughed, you know. But Buck was, you know, I think it was probably 3 years after I met him that Hee-Haw came up. And they called Buck, and they had a list of the characters that they wanted for this show. You know, they told him we're going to do a country and western type laugh, and to which he told me that. And he said, "They're going to call it Hee-Haw." I said, "He what?" And he said, "Hee-Haw." I said, "He what?" "Hee-Haw, Lou, like a donkey." "Oh, okay." Well, the next thing I knew, they flew me to Nashville, stood me up in front of a camera, and held up their cue card, and I read it, and I heard one of them say, "Wow, she's incredible." And I said, "Give me your money and watch me get better, okay?" So they went for it. And back then I was crazy. I used to do things to those people in the booth back there, couldn't even talk about.
Oh.
I was crazy.
What was your character defined as? What were they looking for?
I think they were looking for a fat, funny girl. I do. Because they had a list. Buck said they gave him a list. One gorgeous blonde, one gorgeous brunette, one boy next door type, one girl next door type, one fat, dumb man, one fat, dumb woman. And Buck said, "Got your girl. She's in Dallas."
Becoming famous for this person that you were on Hee-Haw, and also knowing that back at the orphanage, the kids were making fun of your weight, and now it's being emphasized on national television, your weight. Was that hard?
It wasn't hard. It wasn't, because all I could do was go, you know, and you. I do remember thinking, wow, you know, who would ever think that, you know, a fat girl would be put in a show, and emphasis was placed on her being fat, And they wanted me to be fat and be funny, you know. And that was, you know, I had never even heard of anything like that. So I ran with it. Ooh, honey.
You certainly did for 25 years and continue.
Yeah.
And continue on. The cornfield sketches on Hee Haw. Most memorable. Tell me about how those would work.
Okay. They did everything in segments. Okay. So, like, if we were going to do the truck stop, they'd do it maybe on a Monday morning, and there was 13 shows, so there'd be 13 truck stops. Okay. We'd do them all at once. They'd number them, edit, do all that stuff in the, you know, in a editing room and put the shows together. We never saw the shows until you saw them. So we were just like everybody else. But for Cornfield Day now, that involved the entire cast, which means everybody had to come in. Everybody had to have makeup. Everybody had to be in costume at 9 o'clock in the morning. So I mean, we started, you know, they started in there at 5:30, 6 o'clock getting makeup and stuff. And then they put everybody in the cornfields, and if you were lucky enough that your legs worked, you just got to bend down and jump up. If not, you got an apple box to set on and then get up and then set on. But you were up and down and up and down and up and down, and for the first 2 or 3 days that we did that, everybody was so sore, you didn't even talk to anybody hardly after, you know. It was like, your legs hurt so bad. It's like, I don't want to talk to you. I don't even want to walk, okay? It was funny. It was.
When it comes to the truck stop sketches or the cornfield sketches, is there one that sticks out in your mind that you remember as your favorite?
There was one board fence that I did that I thought was very cute. And the truck stop, there were so many of those. Dub Taylor was so funny. And he came in, and then Roy Acuff, okay. And just some of the greatest people. Sammy Davis Jr. Mm. Wonderful, you know. What was the first thing I told you? I've forgotten, so I was going to tell you something. Went away. It'll come back.
The show ran 25 years, but that is a run... a great long run. There's no runs like that today on television. Mm-hmm. What do you attribute that to? To this show that when it came on in the summer, which is not the greatest time for a show to come on.
It was actually a replacement show.
Replacement show.
Smothers Brothers, I think it was.
And did not get good reviews
in
the beginning.
They said we were going to roll downhill fast in that haystack, you know. I think that America sat down in front of their television and an hour later found that they had laughed themselves into a stupor and thought, wow. It was mindless entertainment. you didn't have to think for an hour. All you could do is sit and watch these people be ridiculously silly and laugh. And I think that took America by storm because it put people in a place for an hour, 1 hour a week. They didn't have to think. They didn't have to worry about problems. They didn't have to worry about money woes or, you know, or children or whatever. They just sit and just were gloriously entertained by a bunch of, you know, I don't know if we weren't stupid, but we certainly acted stupid, you know, funny people. And I just, it's to my thoughts, okay, being able to get a good belly laugh out of something, boy, it sets those little endorphins free, you know, it does. And I think what happened with Hee Haw was it caused unexpected, I don't know if I'd say joy, but laughter and creativity, you know, you'd think would not come from a bunch of country hicks. It was just so different that people were captured by it. They were.
It's very interesting because we had somebody in here this morning who wanted to meet you who had said they had watched Hee Haw last night. It does replay an awful lot. But you told me the last time we spoke that you don't watch them.
I think at the very most I may have seen three shows through all these years.
Now, what's the reason for that?
I can't stand to see myself on television because television makes you look at least 30 pounds heavier. And all my life I've fought to not look 5 pounds heavier. So I think that's what it was. I just hated the way that I looked. You know, my son has grabbed me a couple times and said, "Mom, sit down, we're going to watch this." And I'll watch it with him, you know. But it was just not something that I watched because I was too self-conscious. It was all about me. It was. Mm-hmm. I didn't even stop to think about how funny it was and how talented the other people were. I was just so upset with the way that I looked, you know, that it was scary to me. It was.
When Hee Haw ended and life goes on, where did the weight go from there? Because you did at one point have a surgery done.
Oh, I did. I had two or three of them. Yeah. I did everything I could to try to get that weight off of me. finally, somehow, I guess it all worked, went together. You know, I'm still overweight, but not grossly overweight like I was. And I can get around real well. I'm 73 years old, and I have knees that go, no! Like everybody else, you know, at 73. But outside of that, I'm in great shape. I am. You know, God's just really just blessed my life. He has, with good health. He has.
There's so many great people who were on the Hee Haw show. I want to talk about a few of them here. Tell us about Minnie Pearl.
Minnie was magic. She was. When she came into the dressing room, she was Sarah Ophelia Cannon. And she talked and she'd make you laugh. And she was very sophisticated. She was a well-bred woman, she was. But when she put that dress and that hat on, honey, she changed. She turned into Minnie. And she didn't go back to Sarah until she took that dress and that hat off. She was amazing. She was. Her timing on things was just impeccable. I've always been one who just, you know, I think a lot of humor has to do with timing, the ability to say things right or get things right. And Miss Minnie was, boy, she was on top of it. She was so good. Mm-hmm. She'd get in that dressing room back there and I'd say, "You stop it. You're killing me. You're making me laugh too much." You know, "Oh, Lulu, stop."
Grandpa Jones.
Precious. Precious. But honey, let me tell you what, you didn't want to make him mad. Lamar Jones was a fireball, honey, whenever you upset him. But for the most part, if you just came in and watched him and observed a little while, you would think he's very quiet, you know. And he didn't talk much, you know, to outsiders when we were working. He talked to us. And most of the time, he was off to himself picking, you know. Working on, you know, I guess, you know, chords and stuff. But Paul was a sweetheart. He'd come and put his arm in and pat me, you know, tell me love is precious.
Roy Clark.
Hero. Probably the best timing of anybody I ever knew in my life, Roy Clark. Yep. He had the comedy. He was the golden boy, okay, with what he said and how he said it. And the ability to make you laugh until you hurt. He was awesome. He was.
What was it like to work on Hee Haw with Buck Owens?
Now, Buck and I were great friends, okay? Now, I know other people, you know, I've heard some people say, "Well, I didn't really," you know. You had to let me think of the right thing to say here. You had to motivate him to kind of want to work with you on whatever it is you were working towards. Buck was very smart and very personable. He was nice. I mean, the epitome of nice. And was just a wonderful, wonderful human being. He was. I loved Buck. Buck was the one that got me on the show.
When you look back at all the great guest stars, I know people remember Johnny Cash so well when he was there, and so many of the other great ones. Do you have a favorite one that stopped by?
I do, and of course Johnny was one of them, because Johnny would sit on that set over there while we were waiting. You know, everybody had to take turns. And tell me about his dreams and how the Lord interpreted them for him. It was amazing. It was just, you know, it was one of those things I just felt like I was supposed to keep in my heart. I wasn't supposed to really share with anyone. But he really opened his heart and shared with me about dreams that God had given him, about how things were working out and stuff. I would have to say the one that got me was Sammy Davis Jr. Mm. I loved Sammy Davis Jr. Now, he was a little bitty guy. He come and he had all these rings, okay? He just had hands full of rings and jewelry and bracelets and stuff. And they put us in the cornfield. While we were in the cornfield, I just started taking his rings off, putting them on my hands. While we were talking, just taking them all off. And he just let me do it, you know? And then he stopped and went, <You know? laughs> But he was so funny. Sammy was so funny. He'd dance behind that thing and strut out that thing, then come back and stand real still and do his stuff, you know. He was wonderful.
When you look back at this life, getting to work on a network television series, getting to work with these great artists, legendary people, and, you know, there are ups and there are downs. We talked about some of the downs, being born an orphan, going through some of the drug issues. Yeah. How do you look back on the life as a whole? How would you describe it?
You know, even with all the things that I've been through, the word that comes to my mind is gift. It's all been a gift from God, it has. Can't explain it any other way. That's, you know... realizing that someone loves me so much that they've just given me more than I could ever deserve.
Mm. It's absolutely tremendous, and we do want to remind people again that Lulu will be at Perkins Restaurant tonight from 5 to 9 p.m. signing and selling copies of her new book, This Is My Story, This Is My Song. The autobiography, it's going to be tremendous. And by the way, if you come to Perkins tonight and buy a copy of the book, you get 10% off your meal.
Yep.
So it's going to be a lot of fun tonight there from 5 to 9. And Lulu is going to be with us here on the air up through 4 o'clock today. And we're certainly going to have a lot of fun here this morning, 53 minutes past the hour, about 7 minutes left before our break here. But Lulu, today, what is something you haven't done you still want to do?
Let me think. I want to see the Swiss Alps.
Mm.
I do. I want to see that. And if I get a good chance at it, I want to zip line through them.
There you go.
I love to zip line. I do. I think that would be awesome.
not too bad. Is there anything career-wise that you haven't gotten to do that you still want to do?
You know, I always kind of wanted to do maybe television. What do you call them? Little television
like a
shows.
Sitcom?
Sitcom.
Sitcom.
I'd love to do a sitcom. I would. I would love to do that. I think that would be terribly, terribly fun.
It'd be a lot of fun to see you in a sitcom. Did you ever go on many auditions out in Hollywood?
Not too much because I was so busy, you know. I was busy on one show, and it was hard to try to jump to get, you know, to another one.
In recent years, you've worked with Dolly Parton. Mm-hmm. What's she like?
She is... The word that comes to my mind with Dolly is pure. Pure heart, pure love, pure joy. She's just pure. She is. She's wonderful.
What is her place in country music?
Say it again.
What is her place in country music?
I'd have to call her the queen. I would.
Been around a while.
Mm-hmm. Yep. We're both the same age. She's 5 months older than me. yeah. I think Dolly is the topper. She is.
What gives somebody like that such staying power? Where she can still do movies today, she can still be on television, she can still release albums and they can sell well. What is it about her that's allowed her to last nearly five decades now?
I think probably the same thing with me, honey. She knows Jesus. It's the power of the blood, honey. That's what it is. Now, I'm sure some people would go, oh, boy. I believe that with all my heart. I believe that if God has a plan for your life, He's going to work it. Doesn't matter how old you are. Doesn't matter how weak or poor or rich or, you know, whatever. If God has a plan for your life, and I believe He has a plan for every life, He's going to work it. He is.
Do you have any regrets?
I do. One. And I always say this. In the orphan's home, they gave us great opportunity to learn things. That's the one thing that they focused on, was they focused on sending us out into the world completely armed, shall we say, with knowledge of how to take care of ourselves. I mean, we were sent to cooking school. I took verotyping, which is newspaper, okay? I took cosmetology, okay? We worked in the laundry. We worked in the kitchen. I peeled more potatoes in my lifetime than I think anybody has ever. They had great, huge, round things like this of potatoes, and we had to do five of them in the morning and five of them at night. At the orphan's home, because there was, you know, 800 to 1,500 kids there. I'm a good potato peeler, boy. I can move.
A lot of practice there, that's for sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
And now, what did you ask me is complete gone.
The regret.
Oh, regret. That's it. They gave us piano lessons. I wanted to play piano so bad. But I am such a hound, okay? I messed up. I decided while nobody was looking, I was going to play chopsticks with my toes. Ding, 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 ding. And it worked real well until the door went, what are you doing? Out I went. I never got to take piano lessons after that. And that's the one thing I regret, because, you know, with my music, oh, if I could play the piano, it would be so much better. And I thought about trying to do it, you know, but I've never really had the time to concentrate as much as I'd want to do that, you know. I would love to be able to play beautifully, but I'm thankful the Lord lets me sing.
Speaking of singing, you're out performing all over the place. You'll be in Ohio on Sunday performing. When you go, do you have a favorite song you like to perform?
Well, right now, the one that everybody asks for the most is At Last, Etta James' song. And I love that one. I do. And I love my gospel music, and I've just been real blessed. I mean, you know, nowadays people want to hear country. They want to hear gospel. They definitely want to hear At Last. I get that everywhere I go. It's pretty neat when people want to hear you sing, you know, a little bit this, a little of that. And to be able to get to do it, that's great.
Lulu Roman is the guest today all day here on WWGH Radio, right up through 4 p.m., and we certainly thank her for that. And then again, don't forget, 5 to 9, just a little jaunt over to Perkins. Lulu will be signing copies of her book, This Is My Story, This Is My Song, The Autobiography of Lulu Roman. And remember tonight, if you buy a copy of this book between 5 and 9 at Perkins, you get 10% off your meal. There is no better deal than that. Next hour, we've got the Wheeze and Adam the Computer Guy joining us, so we're going to keep on going. 15-minute break, and we'll be back. Lulu, this has been a lot of fun, and we're going to continue on. We'll be back in about 15 minutes.
Okay.
Well, I wasn't that crazy about it, but I accepted it. That's what it was. People thought I was dead. And I would walk into a blooming